Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the Free Speech Movement, a student-led protest movement that galvanized students on college campuses lasting throughout the 60s. It all began on September 14, 1964, when UC Berkeley, under political pressure, announced that existing regulations banning political activity on campus would be strictly enforced. At the time, students said that UC Berkeley administrators wanted to prevent them from organizing on campus around issues surrounding civil rights. Students who organized on campus took action off campus to call for equality and racial justice, and they were very successful. Over the course of 2 months, the free speech movement resulted in 773 arrests and worldwide headlines. The movement eventually ignited a worldwide youth rebellion. To capture this amazing moment in history, playwrights and performers at the Stage Bridge Theater are putting on FSM, a play that celebrates the joy, moral purpose, newborn freedom, and occasional absurdity of being young, part of a movement, and passionately political from a distance that takes account of the consequences. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the legacy of the free speech movement. How did it affect you? What do you remember about it? And how are students and administrators and academics still fighting for their rights to free speech 50 years later? Today, we are joined by Rebecca Rowe. She is development and PR manager for the Stage Bridge Senior Theater, an Oakland-based theater and training ground for senior actors and artists. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Nice to have you. And we're joined by Joan Holden. She's writer of the Free Speech Movement play and former principal playwright for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Joan, when this was happening in 1964, you were in Europe. You just left Berkeley.
Yes. It's a wrong, bad timing.
Yeah, very bad timing. But for doing the research for this play, you relived all of this because you watched a lot of documentaries, you read a lot of books.
I actually didn't watch documentaries, but I was afraid they would influence me too much.
Okay.
That I would try to make it real. But I read all the books and I talked to dozens and dozens of people.
But what was that experience like to revisit this moment in history?
Well, because it was double, because I wasn't there and wished I had been, and always wished I'd had been. But at the same time, it took me back to 1964. Where was I in 1964? What did it feel like being there? When you go back in time like that, you start living there. It takes a while for that period to seep in. It takes a while to be able to remember how it felt, but you get there.
I watched Berkeley in the 60s last night, the documentary,
right?
Just to get a better understanding. I've seen it before, but I wanted to watch it again to get a better understanding of all of this. And a lot of people aren't really clear about the free speech movement and what really sparked that.
I wasn't myself. I had it confused with the filthy speech movement, which followed with the Third World Strike. I didn't really understand the deep connection to the civil rights movement. What happened was a bunch of people who had gone south for Freedom Summer in the summer of 1964 came back to campus to find the tables that they'd always passed out information at and recruited people at, and which people, student, everyone was accustomed to find these tables giving every kind of political opinion at the gateway to the campus, and they were suddenly banned. Mm. Bad timing on the part of the administration.
Why did they decide to do that?
A political pressure, I think. It was very clear. I mean, a lot of businesses were being picketed, had been picketed the year before, throughout the year before. The year before had been the Sheraton Palace sit-in. There were all sit-ins about fair hiring, against discrimination in hiring. That's what most of the student radical groups were organized to combat. And one place that had, one business that had come under a lot of pressure was the Oakland Tribune. The Oakland Tribune was owned by ex-Senator William Noland and had been for years. And he was either on the Board of Regents then or he had friends on the Board of Regents. And they put a lot of pressure on the university.
And a lot of this was percolating because of what was happening in 1960 with the House Un-American Activities Committee. So any views that were left of center were labeled subversive.
Right.
And so many people and so many students said, we refuse to go back to McCarthyism and we have to raise our voices.
That was definitely the feeling. I mean, there had been this demonstration at San Francisco City Hall where a HUAC hearing was being held. This was in 1960. That's what you're describing.
Right.
The police walked the students down the steps with fire hoses.
You know, and that dragged them.
And dragged them into paddy wagons. Yeah. This conflict had been going on for many years. I mean, the FSM didn't come out of nowhere. There was a lot of radical organizing going on at Berkeley for at least the past 10 years. At UC Berkeley, it was an organization called Slate, which ran a slate of candidates to defeat the fraternity-controlled student government. And they had been organizing for civil rights and for democracy on campus for 10 years before.
And so what's amazing and what the film Berkeley in the 60s really looks at is that so much activism happened on campus. And as you said, so much of that then went off campus. So there were sit-ins at hotels and businesses. And
Auto Row, restaurants,
and
banks.
It made a lot of people very uncomfortable.
Lucky stores,
yeah.
Shopping. Yeah. There was a lot of activity that towed the line, tread a very careful line between legal and illegal. But there was a lot of very serious-minded civil disobedience on the model of the civil rights movement, which was strictly civil. You know, no violence, no window smashing, not what we're accustomed to see now, or what we've become accustomed to.
And because you spent so much time doing so much research and reading books, what did you learn about just the history? You say that there's really no concise history of this movement. Why not? It seems like there would be.
Because the people who've written about it were participants or enthusiasts in one way or another. So everything, there are good histories. It's just that they have much more information in them than you could possibly contain in a play. Mm-hmm. In a play, you have to boil things down to something very, very essentialized, you know, one arc of action. But it was hard to straighten out. But when people are really into events or a scholar's really into their subject, everything is important. Everything that happened is important. You got to get it all down. It's all, it all mattered. And it hasn't been long enough, I guess, to sift out what are the standout moments. So I had to figure that out for myself.
Yeah, what is the process like writing a play about real events?
You learn all you can. You study. You talk to people. You study. You think. You say. You absorb all the information that you can until a story emerges. Until you begin to see how you could tell the story, and at that point, you don't want to know anything else. You know, the things that you don't are not going to be part of your story. You stop finding out about. Don't tell me about that. Yeah, but I'm not dealing with that. You know.
Kind of like doing research for the radio show on a regular basis.
I'm sure it is. Yeah. It's exactly the same.
Yeah. That is Joan Holden. She is writer of the Free Speech Movement play. It takes place at the Brava Theater Center in San Francisco on September 20th and 21st and Berkeley Rep on September 27th and 28th. And we're also joined in studio by Rebecca Rowe, development and PR manager for the StageBridge Senior Theater. It's an Oakland-based theater and training ground for senior actors and artists. Rebecca, what has it been like for you as a young person to be involved in this process and to revisit that moment in history?
Well, for me, what's interesting to hear about is obviously today there's a lot of discussion about transparency in the media and the government, but it's basically unfathomable to think that on university campuses that people really weren't allowed to speak their minds at that time. You know, being of a younger generation, I just find that shocking. And so it's interesting to see how the free speech movement really set the stage for liberation movements that followed.
Do you find yourself comparing your experience in college to what happened at Berkeley? I mean, was there a vibrant, you know, were students really active where you went to school?
To some extent, I feel like I was in a bit of a transitional time period when I was in school. So it was kind of before the Occupy movement and kind of after the repression. So not as much, but I did take a class that looked at revolutionary movements on college campuses and was definitely aware of it to some extent. But what surprised me was that just how impactful the free speech movement was, and that I really, having studied on the East Coast, wasn't as aware of it as I'm glad to be now.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting to look at Berkeley back in the 60s and UC Berkeley today.
Yeah, what I've been hearing from Joan and from other students who were there at the time of the movement is that, you know, when I think of Berkeley, there's this kind of stereotypical portrait of the flower children that I've been passed down. But according to Joan, you know, people were really much more square and buttoned up. You know, she mentioned that women were never in pants at the time of FSM. And that's so interesting to me.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that, Joan? I mean, when we see the image of students on the cop car, they all took their shoes off to climb on the cop car.
Right. They didn't want to damage the car.
Right.
I was left with a huge dent, though, because that car said, well, that's the first thing that I found out, actually, because everybody thinks about the occupation of Sproul Hall as the mega event where Mario Savio made his famous speech about you've got to put your bodies on the gears and on the levers of the machine. But actually, 2 months earlier was the hugest event, which was when students sat down around a police car. What had happened is that the student groups and everybody from everybody from the Young Socialist League to the Young Republicans joined in a protest against the table ban. So it was the complete spectrum, the complete political spectrum, had decided in a united front, made a decision to put the tables back to defy the ban. And the chancellor called the campus police, and they decided to make an arrest. But they picked a non-student, Jack Weinberg, and they put him. They drove. This is unfathomable. The students, you know, the campus is already up in arms about this, and hundreds, if not thousands, of students are signing petitions and milling around the tables. And they drive a police car onto the campus and arrest a guy at the tables and put him in a car. And somebody yelled, sit down. And 300 people immediately sat down. And very quickly, 3,000 people surrounded them. It was Mario Savio who was the first person to get up, who had the inspiration to use the police car as a pulpit, to stand on the top of it. But he carefully took his shoes off. And laid out and gave a passionate speech laying out the reasons why they were there, why everybody was there. And this turned into a teach-in that lasted for 32 hours. Mm. They stayed all that night and into the next afternoon. finally, the governor asked the chancellor to negotiate with asked the president to negotiate with the students. And then there followed 2 months of negotiations and stalling on the part of the administration until it all burst out again.
When students were on top of the car speaking for, I think it was 3 minutes, right? That's what they had, about 3 minutes each? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a great scene in Berkeley in the 60s. They were talking about how a lot of the fraternities were not in support of this. And so they would come to heckle. And then the students said, well, why don't you come join us? Talk to us. What don't you like about this? So one of the frat guys got on the car and didn't know what to say. And then his own frat booed him.
Yeah.
And so, but it's so interesting because this galvanized so many people from different political perspectives. I mean, you had Youth for Goldwater and the Young Socialists Alliance coming together. Usually these groups wouldn't speak to each other, but Here they were talking about where they wanted this to go.
We are students. The purpose of the university is intellectual inquiry. It is, you know, to discuss, to think, to argue, to consider, and you are depriving us of that right. It outraged thousands of students who had never been political before, who had never done anything political. Of course, the most politicized students were the first to jump on it, but it reached way, way, way beyond that.
Joan Holden is writer of the Free Speech Movement Play, which kicks off at the Brava Theater Center in San Francisco on September 20th. It'll also play there on the 21st, and then it'll go over to Berkeley Rep September 27th and 28th. You can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Rebecca Rowe. She's development and PR manager for the Stage Bridge Senior Theater, an Oakland-based theater and training ground for seniors and actors. And today we are talking about the legacy of the free speech movement. We'd love to hear from you. What do you remember about it? If you were part of it or inspired by it, we'd love to hear from you. So many students across the country came to Berkeley because of this movement, and people overseas were reading about it and learning about it. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Also, what is the legacy of the free speech movement today? If you're a teacher or a student on one of our many college campuses, what are your thoughts on the state of free speech today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have an email from John in Santa Cruz. Actually, he couldn't stand the line. He wanted to say that window smashing and violence are not what we have become accustomed to in protest today. It's only a small minority committing violence, but many are just as respectful as the students back in the 60s.
Oh, I know that's true. I didn't mean to suggest that, you know, that that everybody's rioting in the streets today, but it was absolutely unthinkable at that time.
Did you want to jump in, Rebecca? Well, now I would like to welcome Daniel Savio, who is Mario Savio's son, and he is the composer for the Free Speech Movement play. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi. One of two composers, actually.
One of two. Okay, thank you. Well, what's it been like for you to be involved in this process and to revisit this movement?
Since it is a part of my family history, there's definitely been a deeply personal part of the experience the whole time. It hasn't just been another job, that's for sure. But I'm just so happy to be working with such experienced people. Joan and Bruce, my co-composer, have been enormously helpful to me. I've learned an incredible amount working with them, and even when we don't agree on everything.
You mean like yesterday?
Yeah.
And Daniel, I'm sure that, I mean, because this is such a great part of your family history, I mean, first off, what was it like for you to grow up with the history of the free speech movement throughout your childhood and as you got older?
Right. I didn't think of it as weird or special until at least high school and maybe even college. Until that point, it was just that was what my life was that my parents and lots of their friends were involved in this thing back in the day, and I found it very exciting. I was taught early on about the issues, and unlike many or most of my friends, I've never had any need to rebel against my parents. There was never any teenage rebellion because I always agreed with what they said. what it was like, it was a very political household. We talked about politics at the dinner table. That was not considered rude. And I love it. it's always been something that I've enjoyed and still enjoy.
We have an email from Carl who says, I'd be curious to hear what the approach was to developing the character of Mario Savio in the play. I got to know him later as a fellow physics student and loved the headline, Savio Finally Gets Degree. And though he was obviously charismatic, I was always a little surprised by how somebody with such a contemplative bent became such a public leader.
Well, I think Joan does a great job of synthesizing multiple views. I mean, Mario is described alternately as being a contemplative and very gentle person to talk to, but also as a firebrand. And I think we've got both of those elements in the show. Joan?
No, at first I was terrified of doing the character of Mario Savio. And at first I thought I would not. The play would just tell a story of three rank and file members of the FSM. And if Mario were included at all, he would be seen at a distance. Hmm. Because it's very intimidating to do a real person when people who really knew him are still alive. After that, after that generation is gone, then you have liberty to invent. But you really don't have liberty to invent a real person. You have to find out who he is. So my first instinct was no. And besides, he's over-identified with the FSM. That is, the FSM is over-identified with him, as the charismatic leader. And actually, we should emphasize that it was a mass movement. So in the first iteration, this play has been workshopped twice. Which has been very great for us. The first version, Mario, I really only used his words and kept him at a distance. So you saw him, you saw the speeches, but there were no close-up scenes with him. And a friend and former collaborator of mine, Henry Picciotto, buttonholed me after the performance and was furious. You give us all these other people and you don't give us Mario. Show us Mario. We want Mario.
Wow.
And if he hadn't been so vehement, I might not have heard it, but I heard it. So in the second version, he becomes a character that you spend some time with. He's a very... he is very double, contemplative and philosophical, and at the same time, when politically inspired, incapable of anything.
Daniel, what is it like to watch someone play your father?
Oh, it's actually really wonderful. When I first saw it, we've had the same person. Like Joan said, we've workshopped the show twice now, and Brady Morales Woolery has been our Mario the entire time. And when I first saw it, I was a little, before I saw it, rather, I was like, how is this going to work? I don't see how this is even possible. And then when I saw the show, I was just blown away. It's a combination of Joan's work with the script and Brady's fantastic work, that even though, I never knew my father in the 60s, I was born in 1980. I know at least a little bit of what he was like then through the videos and through discussions with my mother. I felt like he was brought back to life on the stage there. So it was really fantastic. And I think that people who knew him in the 60s are going to feel the same way, I hope.
And that is Daniel Savio, the son of Mario Savio. Daniel is one of two composers involved in the Free Speech Movement play. Rebecca Rowe is development and PR manager for the Stage Bridge Senior Theater, and Joan Holden is writer of the Free Speech Movement play. Kicks off at the Brava Theater in San Francisco September 20th and 21st, and then moves over to the East Bay Berkeley Rep September 27th and 28th. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. I'm Matt Martin, general manager here at Local Public Radio, with Becca Hoekstra, producer for Your Call. We are asking for your support, keeping the programming uninterrupted, with your calls and clicks to 800-525-9917, or you can go online to KALW.org.
During this hour, we've been talking about this play, the Free Speech Movement. And if you want to see this play, during this hour only, we are giving away 6 pairs of tickets with a $100 donation in the phone room. You can go see this play that we've been talking about in this past hour about the 1964 Free Speech Movement at UC Berkeley and how this has impacted the Free Speech Movement around campuses around the country. This political movement was huge, and if you want to see it, a $100 donation this hour only will get you a pair of tickets to go see the performance.
800-525-9917. Only during this hour of your call are we offering this thank you gift. So if you'd like to be there at the Brava Theater, it's a great opportunity. And also to say yes to these kind of engaged, thoughtful conversations. If you're a fan of Rose Aguilar and the work that her team does, your support makes it possible. You can also go to KALW.org and see other thank you gifts there.
Call the number 800-525-9917 or donate at KALW.org.
800-525-9917. Support your call. And we do have a challenge during this hour. We have Paul Hajanan in San Francisco, a generous listener who said if 15 people will join or give their support to KALW during this hour, he will kick in an additional $500 for local public radio. 800-525-9917. Support KALW. Support uninterrupted programming during fundraising and keep this station strong. KALW.org or 800-525-9917.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Dana Goldstein about her book, The Teacher Wars, chronicling the history of teaching. She says that the teacher wars that we hear today are really nothing new, and she delves into this into her really interesting book, so you'll want to tune in to that tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are marking the 50th anniversary of the Free Speech Movement by talking about a new play, FSM, that kicks off September 20th at the Brava Theater, runs through the 21st, and then it starts September 27th and runs through September 28th at Berkeley Rep. And it takes a look at the student-led protest movement that galvanized protests on college campuses lasting throughout the 1960s. It all began on September 14th, 1964, when UC Berkeley announced that existing regulations banning political activity on campus would be strictly enforced. And at the time, students were doing so much activism on campus and then took it off campus to hotels and stores and really disrupted society. And so the administrators cracked down, arresting 773 people over the course of 2 months. And we're talking about the play today with Rebecca Rowe, development and PR manager for the Stage Bridge Senior Theater. That's an Oakland-based theater and training ground for senior actors and artists. Joan Holden is writer of the Free Speech Movement play and former principal playwright for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. We're also joined by Daniel Savio, the son of Mario Savio, who was instrumental in this movement. Daniel is one of two composers who worked on the Free Speech Movement play. And we'd love to hear from you. If you were part of this movement, if you were inspired by it, if you just remember it, and you'd like to talk about what stood out for you, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you teach at a school or if you're a student, what is the current status of the Free Speech Movement? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, if you have any questions about that time, we'd love to hear from you. Before the show, when I was talking with Joan and Rebecca, I learned, and I didn't know this, that the vice chancellor at UC Berkeley at the time was an informant for the FBI. And I understand, Joan, that you learned that thanks to the book that came out when you were doing your research by Seth Rosenfeld. We've had him on the show, called Subversives.
It came out perfect timing for me, just as I was beginning to work on this, and widened the story enormously, put it in a historical context. The FBI never infiltrated FSM. The Free Speech Movement, but it had it under surveillance from the very beginning. I learned from Seth's book that the Berkeley office of the FBI was bigger than the San Francisco one. Hoover considered Berkeley to be the big threat.
Wow.
as somebody who grew up in Berkeley, to learn that the seventh floor of the American Trust Building, which was then the tallest building in Berkeley, was the FBI office, was secretly the FBI office, blew my mind.
Wow.
Yeah. Hoover considered students to be a very serious threat. And he considered Clark Kerr, the president of the university, and this is one of the ironies of the story, who was a student's bête noire, absolute nemesis. I mean, people still bristle when you mention his name, people who were in the FSM. But Hoover had Clark Kerr on his enemies list and had for years.
We actually have a caller right now about Clark Kerr, so let's hear from Molly in Carmel. Hi, Molly. Great timing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was just curious what you all included about that whole piece, because I guess whatever accommodation Kerr eventually made with the students, that Reagan, I think, fired him, and it seems like the whole university system became much more tightened up in a certain academic sense.
You can say that. It's complicated.
Yeah.
It's complicated and simple at the same time. Reagan really rose to power by whipping the students. You know, the FSM handed him a torch to ignite reaction with. And Hoover aided and abetted him at every step. Hoover fed him information, which the FBI had gotten from the vice chancellor, who later became Reagan's secretary of education, if you remember that, Alex Sheriffs. It's complicated. One of my collaborators, Bruce Barthel, the only one of us, of the three of us, who was there at the time, was the first thing he said to me when I proposed this to him was, the FSM elected Reagan. That's an oversimplification, but it gave him his opportunity, gave him his opening.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
And his first act was to get the Regents to fire Kerr.
Right.
And his second was to get them to impose tuition for the first time on the whole university and state college system.
And wasn't Kerr reaching some kind of agreement with the FSM?
Not so much. Every time Kerr was stalling the whole time. Kerr hoped it would go away, you know. He underestimated the students terribly. But he had mumblers at his side, especially the chancellor, and the chancellor was being instigated by the vice chancellor. So they had nearly worn the students out after 2 months of fruitless negotiations. There was a sit-in which had failed. It looked like all was lost, and people were about to go home for Thanksgiving when the chancellor, instigated by the vice chancellor, sent letters of suspension to four of the leaders, including Mario. Hmm. And as soon as the campus heard about that, it exploded. The FSM was reborn.
Wow.
Students occupied Sproul Hall, and the rest is history. Hmm.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you for doing this work.
Thank you.
And come see it.
You can give us a call at you can find information about the play at yourcallradio.org and give us a call at 866-798-8255. Today we are talking about the free speech movement. It's been 50 years since that student-led movement at UC Berkeley, which galvanized students around the world. If you remember that time, if you have any questions about it, we'd love to hear from you. And if you are a teacher on campus today or a student, what is the status of free speech and movements on campuses today? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Mario, what did you learn during the process of working on this play? I'm sorry, Daniel.
you mean what did I learn about FSM?
Well, was there anything new nuggets, like the thing that I just mentioned about UC Berkeley... the vice chancellor at UC Berkeley, who was an informant for the FBI. Did you learn any new nuggets?
Yeah, well, this point that Joan was just speaking about is so important, because one of our worries, I think, going into the show was that it might come across to audiences as some kind of 60s nostalgia piece, which we've gotten a lot of over the last 10 years or so. And we really didn't want that. We thought that there was a lot more importance and depth to the story than that, and we wanted that to be in there too. And because of this book, Subversive, we were able to include that. So I really think that the inclusion of the details about Hoover and the FBI and Reagan put the context there so that it's a much bigger story than it otherwise would have been. And it really, I think it makes the whole thing in a very real way.
And Rebecca, what about you? What did you learn that you didn't know before?
Well, it's just interesting to see that, kind of as we've been alluding to, that you can't really classify the 60s as one generic time period, and that it really was a transitional time. And I just begin to see FSM as being in 1964, there's still remnants of the 50s in place, and the way that kind of what's happening in the mid-60s leads to the late 60s and onwards. So that's been really great to see. I think Joan does a really great job of capturing the spirit of that specific time period that predates this sort of 60s nostalgia that Danielle is talking about.
And you can find information about the play at yourcallradio.org. FSM debuts September 20th at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. It's September 20th and 21st, and then moves over to Berkeley Rep September 27th and September 28th. And we've got an email from Carol who says, please compare the current political climate on the Berkeley campus to the climate of the 60s. I can't imagine any kind of mass movement occurring on the campus today. Reasons may be many more students care more about getting a job rather than being educated for its own sake, a much higher percentage of foreign students who wouldn't be interested in participating, and the city of Berkeley's corporate interests more prominent today than they were in the 60s.
The writer really kind of nailed it, actually. And we sort of mentioned this in the show, too, that it's just the issues today are much more complicated than the issues were then, although the issues then have an impact on today as well. And so it's like asking the students today to do something like what was done in the 60s, first of all, wouldn't work. The same kinds of tactics won't work. And so maybe the people who have been in, say, Occupy may look at the 60s and say, oh, they were so naive. And the people in the 60s may look at the people in Occupy and say, oh, they're disorganized. But the fact is that they're no longer, unfortunately, truly comparable situations. Things have really changed.
In part because of that thing you mentioned, which is a direct consequence of the FSM, tuition and student loans, which I have to look at as an instrument of repression. Students today, when I went to school, the University of California was free. You paid something like $415 a year in fees for the health service, you know, and for the student government. That fact that students graduate owing $100,000 is enormous, enormous change.
It's so easy to forget that tuition was free back then because students collectively owe about $1 trillion today. Yeah. Rebecca, did that stand out for you as a young person?
I find that shocking. It's just, it seems like to what Daniel was saying, there's almost just too much at stake. Your college is such an experience, is such an investment that it's dangerous to give that up for something you're passionate about, sadly enough.
Yeah, and your parents have sacrificed to send you there enormously. It works so beautifully to keep youth quiet. When I graduated from school, from college, you felt like you'd get a job, you'd quit it. You know, if you didn't like it, you'd quit it, and you'd walk down the street and get another one next week. It was like that.
And that's so not the case today. Today we are talking about the Free Speech Movement play with Joan Holden. She's writer of the play and former principal playwright for the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Rebecca Rowe is development and PR manager for the Stage Bridge Senior Theater. And Daniel Savio, son of Mario Savio, is one of two composers who worked on FSM. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about your memories of the free speech movement, what is its legacy? How does it affect students today? In just a couple minutes, I want to ask you all about an email that was sent out just recently by the Chancellor of UC Berkeley, Nicholas Dirks, concerning the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement. So what are your thoughts? What do you remember? What stands out for you? What questions do you have? And when we look at things like the Occupy movement, or I just thought of the pepper spraying horrible incident at UC Davis, what stands out for you about what is or is not happening on campuses today? I mean, part of the problem is we just don't hear about it because it doesn't get covered.
Yeah.
So we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. I mean, students are doing such great work when it comes to sweatshops,
yes,
janitor pay, farm workers. I mean, if you can search for it and find it, but it doesn't always make headlines. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Daniel, I want to be sure that we don't end the show today I want to talk about the music because you're one of two composers. What was that process like for you? How did you decide what kind of music to use for this play?
Well, we had a lot of initial ideas, some of which have stayed with us, some of which haven't. So the very first thing we thought of was, oh, we should use the sound of the folk protest music of the time. So, you know, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, these kinds of sounds. Not their songs, but that sound. And a lot of that is still in there, but it's been expanded because as we delved deeper into the story, it became obvious that different aspects of the story and different characters within the story needed to sing in different styles. I mean, if we were going to have J. Edgar Hoover sing a song, he couldn't sing folk protest music. That wouldn't make any sense. So it's gotten expanded, and I think we've tried to borrow a little bit from the kind of Kurt Weill sound, because he also did music that kind of had its feet in two camps, a little bit of politics and a little bit of folk sensibility within a theatrical context. And we also, once we had an actual band that told us what the actual sound of our instruments was going to be, that gave us a little more information. So it's a diverse score, but it's fun, and it's you leave the theater humming the songs, I believe. That's the hope, anyway.
Well, we have a caller who can't stay long, so let's go to Jolie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jolie.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that in the 60s, there was a draft, and there was a war. And that made uprising a very personal thing to students on campus. I would bet that if we had a draft today, there would be a lot more activity on campus.
I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, I also agree. Mm-hmm. Quite right, caller.
Yeah, it makes it pretty personal there. And I have to say that I also agree with the whole idea of the cost of education being repressive. You know, I used to, in my innocence, think that nobody would actually do something like that. I don't think that anymore. I really do think that when you put people in debt, you repress them and you hold them down. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in, Jolie.
Yeah.
Joan, do you want to comment?
She said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what else would we say exactly?
Well, I mean, you know,
well, okay. One comment.
Yeah.
The FSM, what she said about the war and how the war ignited students across the country. I mean, everybody, the whole generation, rose up against the draft. But I want to remind everybody that in 1964, though the war was escalating, Vietnam was escalating, it was very much on the fringe of our consciousness. It was about to burst. It was about to occupy the center of our consciousness, but it didn't. It was something in early 64. It was something. What was happening was Freedom Summer. What was happening was the freedom rights. It was a civil rights struggle, and the war, which a year later would be the number one issue for our generation, was barely in our consciousness.
Here's the connection, though, is that if the subsequent war protests had not been so successful as they were, it's possible that we would now be living in a society where the government had not tightened the screws quite so much, because they wouldn't be afraid quite so much. So, I mean, this is, you know, we're now experiencing the pushback against these last 50 years. That's part of why the tuition has increased, part of why the screws are being tightened.
Well, and last Friday, the chancellor of UC Berkeley, Nicholas Dirks, sent out an email about the 50th anniversary of the movement, arguing that civility is a prerequisite for free speech. He wrote, quote, "We can only exercise our right to free speech insofar as we feel safe and respected in doing so, and this in turn requires that people treat each other with civility. Simply put, courteousness and respect in words and deeds are basic preconditions to any meaningful exchange of ideas. In this sense, free speech and civility are two sides of a single coin, the coin of open democratic society," end quote.
There are parts of it I agree with, there are parts of it I disagree with. I disagree with the characterization of them being two sides of the same coin. I think they're actually on the same side of the coin. the other side of the coin is actually the need to have the right to be uncivil sometimes. Mm-hmm. When it is necessary. He's right. He's right in an educational institution that you need to provide a place where people are going to feel safe being themselves, but he's not right about the idea that you need to consider your words before you speak them in the political sense. Yes, in politeness, of course. It's a concerning statement, I think.
John?
Yeah, why did he say that now? What was he trying to head off? It's important, the phrase civil disobedience is very important. What does that mean? It means you don't cross, you don't cross the line into violence. You don't cross the line into outrage, but you break the law when necessary. Mario cited the example of Thoreau not paying taxes to support the war with Mexico, because there was no slavery in Mexico, because that war, if the United States had won, it would have been spread slavery into Mexico. In his essay, Civil Disobedience, the right to disobey is very important.
This play kicks off on September 20th, and it's going to hopefully raise awareness and start a conversation again about what happened in the 1960s and where we are today. What message do you think this will send to students of this generation? Or are you hoping it sends? Just quickly, Joan.
Stand up, open your mouth, and care about things bigger than yourself.
Rebecca, just quickly?
I think that's appropriate. I agree with Joan, because I think this is sometimes the me generation. So I agree with Joan.
And Daniel?
See yourself in a historical context. See your connections to the past and the future.
Good. Very good. Daniel Savio, the son of Mario Savio, is one of two composers who worked on the Free Speech Movement play. Joan Holden wrote the play, and Rebecca Rowe is development and PR manager for Stage Bridge Senior Theater. The play kicks off September 20th at the Brava Theater in San Francisco, September 20th and 21st, and then it moves over to Berkeley Rep, and it'll show September 27th and 28th, and you can check yourcallradio.org for more information. Thank you for joining us, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.